Call to order this meeting of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee for Wednesday, January 28, 2009. First item on our agenda is the approval of the minutes. Members have the minutes in their packets. And are there any corrections?
I'll move adoption if that's...
Senator Bickerman moves that the minutes from January 26 be approved. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The first bill on our agenda is Senate File 131, Senator Bonoff. Senator Lurie will move that Senate File 131 be recommended to pass. Senator Bonoff, do you have any amendments?
No, I do not, Madam Chair.
Then you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here to present the divestment of the State Board of Investment Holdings relating to Iran. I carried a similar bill 2 years ago with regard to Sudan, and so I remember speaking to some of you at this table about that matter. And so before I talk about this bill today, I just wanted to remind members and let people know who aren't aware of it that, in fact, 2 years ago when we brought this forward, we ended up not passing legislation, that, in fact, we worked with the Board of Investment and we passed a resolution that said that we would divest our holdings from companies that did business in the Sudan. And then last year, Senator Pappas carried a bill that did just that, similar to this bill, and we did pass it in the Senate and in the House, and it became law. So there is some precedent for doing this. People asked me 2 years ago, well, why Sudan? You know, are you going to keep doing this with every time there's a problem? And what I said then and still holds true is that it is very specific that the United States has identified only 4 countries on our U.S. State Sponsors of Terror list. The first one was Sudan because of genocide. The second one is Iran, and so it is consistent with that. Also, members should know that the United States government has passed a federal law that says we will not have our holdings in companies that do business in Iran. So this bill
Senator is... Senator Bonoff, what are the other two? Do you recall?
Cuba and Syria.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and we don't have any holdings in those. Thank you. So this bill is regarding our holdings in international companies that do business in Iran. And you have before you the summary of the bill, and so I will go through section by section the summary. The bill establishes a process for the State Board of Investment to use for evaluation of state investments in companies doing business in Iran. And the bill follows a timeline for divestment. We begin with 90 days of notice. Then half of the holdings are within 15 months or within 6 months, and then 15 months finally, the remainder of the holdings. We start, the first section is the definitions. Subdivision 2 requires the State Board of Investment to identify all the companies in which the board has direct or indirect holdings within 90 days after the date of enactment of this legislation. Requires the board to present this list at the first meeting of the State Board of Investment after that time period has expired. The board is then required to update the scrutinized company's listing each quarter based on continuing information. Subdivision 3 requires the board to notify the companies on the listing. The board is directed to offer the company the opportunity to clarify its operations and then encourages the company to convert their operations to an active status. The fourth paragraph requires the board to begin divesting of their securities in a company that's been notified within 90 days after informing the company as required by the legislation, and then subject to a timetable that requires divestment at least 50% of the assets within 9 months, excuse me, I had said six, it's nine, and 100% of the assets within 15 months after the company being notified that they're on this list. Subdivision 5 prohibits the board from acquiring assets of companies that are on this list. Subdivision 6 exempts companies that have been excluded by the federal government. So if our government have said this company is okay, then this legislation does not trump that. Subdivision 7 provides that the board need not take action under this legislation unless it determines that the action is consistent with its fiduciary responsibilities. Subdivision 8 provides that the divestment required by this legislation does not apply to indirect holdings in actively managed investment funds, mutual funds. Requires the board to correspond with the managers, however, of those investment funds requesting that they remove companies with active operations in Iran from their holdings and create a similar fund containing companies that are not contained on the list. If a similar fund is created, this legislation directs the State Board of Investment to promptly replace all applicable investments with the new fund. Subdivision 9 requires that the board provide the scrutinized company's listing within 30 days after creating it to the chairs of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over the board. Paragraph B requires an annual report from the board to the legislative chairs of committees with jurisdiction that would give them a copy of the most recent list, a summary of the correspondence, a listing of the investments that have been sold, a list of all prohibited investments, and a description of progress with regard to the mutual fund companies. Subdivision 10 terminates the requirements of this legislation if any of the following events occur. Iran is removed from the U.S. State Department's list of countries that sponsor terrorism, or the Congress or President declares that mandatory divestment of the type required in this legislation interferes with conduct of U.S. foreign policy. And I would also add that our President Obama, when he was in the U.S. Senate, he offered legislation that enabled states to do this type of legislation because Senator Obama at that time said that it was important for states to recognize the role that they could play in a diplomatic solution. And so he paved the way with that legislation, and 14 other states have taken action similar to what we are proposing and have passed similar legislation. And with that, I would welcome. I have two testifiers with me today.
Let's see. First, are there, before the testimony, are there any specific questions for Senator Bonhoff from the members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonhoff, this list that we have, related securities list, do we know if the Minnesota Investments funds are in these and the percentage that they might be in or the dollar amount?
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, Mr. Bicker is here with us today, and he can address the specific question, but these are funds. I believe that we do have these are companies that we do have funds within, and Mr. Bicker is prepared to talk about our holdings in these companies.
Anyone else? Or Senator Bonhoff, okay? Senator Betsy.
Yeah, thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, in your description, you were saying that reports had to be given to appropriate legislative committees, but it looks like the only reports in here have to go to the Commission on Pensions and Retirement, you know, which is not this committee. It's a separate House and Senate commission. So I'm just trying to find where it's required to be sending it to anybody but the Pensions Commission.
Senator Betzold.
Which section was that in, Senator Betzold?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm looking at page 4 and on line 4.8.
Page 4 of the
4.8,
bill or the summary?
It talks about, well, I'm not looking at the summary, I'm looking at the bill. And Mr. Bodden says that there may be an error in the summary because it appears that the only reports have to go to the Pensions Commission. That's on page 4.8.
4.34.
4.34, right.
Madam Chair, I would defer to Senate counsel on that question.
Mr. Bonner?
Madam Chair and members, if you look at the bottom of page 4, paragraph B does require that basically the State Board of Investment then summarize those the reports it's received and send those to the committees and divisions with jurisdiction over the board.
And what were you referring to, Senator?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm trying to figure out what there's something that's going to be sent to the Pensions Commission.
Where is that?
That's
at the top.
At the top, 4.8, and I think I saw it somewhere else on this page too. 4.13. So there's some information that's being sent to the Pensions Commission, and 4.33 as well too. And then some information that's being sent to the chairs of the legislative committees. And I'm just trying to figure out who gets what and what the differences are.
Mr. Bodden, can you help us out there?
Madam Chair and members, on the exemption report that you see at the top of page 4 is a requirement for when the State Board of Investment determines that it can, in good faith, take the action required by the bill consistent with its fiduciary duties, it then reports that to the chair and vice chair of the LCPR. And then that report includes information specific to individual scrutinized companies. The report required at the bottom of page 4 has to do with the creation of the scrutinized companies list. And then you'll see the listing on the top of page 5 for the specific requirements in the scrutinized companies list, action taken with respect to those companies, and a summary of all investments sold, redeemed, et cetera.
Mr. Bodden, that's not a duplication. That's something different. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Madam Chair, and then Senator Bonhoff, if the bill is proceeding at some point, then the Pensions Commission is going to have to review this, and which is different from the normal legislative process, but I'm just alluding you, and we're going to have to probably look at that as well, too. So thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, I did assume that it would come before the Pensions Committee, and I will make sure to put in a hearing request.
Did Senator Pappas's bill go before the Pension Commission?
Madam Chair, I don't know, but I know when I carried the Sudan bill, I went before the Pensions Committee.
Okay. Senator Pappas's bill apparently went from here to the floor. I don't know whether there was a similar reporting element in it like that. And we're going to hear from your testifiers, and then we'll maybe figure out what the proper path is for this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Senator Ms. Bonhoff, you can call your witnesses. So
first I'd like to call Mr. Eric Dean as a testifier. Mr. Dean is a retired Minnesota Army National Guard. Mr. Dean is a veteran of the Minnesota Army National Guard. While in the National Guard, Mr. Dean was deployed for 11 months in Baghdad, where his unit was attached to the 720th Military Police Battalion, and there he held the rank of Staff Sergeant and commanded a squad of 10 men. During the course of his 12-year career, he received several medals, including the Bronze Star and 3 Army Achievement Medals. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify. As Senator Bonhoff said, my name is Eric Dean. I'm a 12-year veteran of the Minnesota Army National Guard with 11-month service in Baghdad. I've come here to voice my strong support for Senate File 131 because of my experiences on the streets of Baghdad with explosive devices that came from Iran and that were responsible for the injuries of some of the soldiers in my company and for the death of Americans. Little background, I grew up on the farm I live on today, south of Hector, which is about 80 miles straight west of here. I'm a grain farmer of about 1,500 acres. I got my bachelor's degree in egg business from University of Wisconsin, River Falls. And I got my master's degree in agriculture economics from Kansas State University. I first joined the Minnesota Army National Guard when I was 17 and still in high school in August of 2004. And I joined the field artillery unit closest to me in Olivia. And after grad school, I took a job in western Minnesota and then transferred to Alpha Battery, 1st Battalion, 151st Field Artillery out in Marshall, Minnesota. And that's where I was called to active duty in September of 2004.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Sergeant, do you have any background in international investments?
No.
I didn't think so. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, the reason why Mr. Dean is testifying today is because we all know that the reason why, one of the reasons why Iran is on the state-sponsored list of sponsoring terror is because of the threat of Iran funding Hamas, Hezbollah, and the insurgents who have killed American soldiers. And so I thought it was relevant to the legislation to hear from one of our service members who was there and witnessed that. I gather by your question that you don't see the relevance in that way, but that was why I asked Mr. Dean to speak today.
Madam Chair, I don't see the relevance.
Yes. Continue.
Okay. When we got to Iraq, we joined the regular Army unit, 720th MP Battalion, and our job was basically to train Iraqi police in central and southeast Baghdad. You know, on a typical mission, we would roll out in three up-armored Humvees and go out to the Iraqi police station, and oftentimes we would bring an Iraqi police liaison officer who was a U.S. civilian employed by the Department of Defense that had experience in law enforcement, and they would help to train the Iraqi police in, you know, specific police tactics. When we first entered the war at the end of 2004, the insurgents had learned that they couldn't attack us with small arms fire, and so they basically resorted to using the IEDs that, you know, we've heard about so much, or the improvised explosive devices. My squad was actually hit with a car bomb, and luckily the gunner in the second vehicle, the vehicle that got hit with the direct blast, just the parts of him that were exposed on the outside of the Humvee was where he was injured, and the up-armored vehicle itself took the blast very well, and we were actually able to drive it back to base. But then about halfway through our deployment is when we started learning about these EFPs, and they were the explosively formed projectiles that in our briefings we were told came from Iran. And there was a squad in 3rd Platoon that had experience directly with one of the EFPs, and it punched right through the armor on the side of the door, and killed one of the IPLOs, or the Iraqi police liaison officers, in the back seat, and then injured the driver. We were told that in our briefings that, you know, these EFPs are manufactured by kind of special metalworking machines, and we were told to kind of look for them in Baghdad and stuff like that. And you know, just from my experience, you know, as a farmer, you do have to have a fairly large pieces of equipment to kind of make these explosive devices. And, you know, we searched many areas throughout Baghdad looking for this. And that's, you know, further proof that we think that these EFPs, you know, came from Iran. And it actually didn't come out until an official briefing from military officials until around February of 2007, when then they kind of gave a press conference where they told that these EFPs were coming, you know, from Iran.
Thank you. So thank you very much for your service.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Dean, and again, and the committee thanks you for your service, and thank you for being with us today. Mr. John Ress.
Yes, Radson? Professor John Radson. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you. I'm John Radson. I teach at William Mitchell College of Law.
And I've asked Professor Radson here. He is of Iranian descent and used to work for the CIA, so he has some background in this area.
Thank you, Senator. In a situation like this, I think of what advice my father gave me about public speaking. He said, have you ever complained that somebody didn't talk enough? I said, no, Dad, I can't think of that. He said, have you ever thought to yourself that person spoke too much? And I said, often. So I'll try to err on the side of not saying too much. I've divided my remarks into three areas. I'll give you some sense of my background as it relates to Iran, U.S.-Iran relations, sanctions. I think I know the most about that area. Second, I will give you my assessment of the threat that Iran poses to American national security, the threat that Iran poses to our friends in the region. And third, I will summarize why I believe that this proposal is a reasonable and wise proposal in trying to affect the behavior of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I recognize that this measure by itself is not going to deter the behavior of the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khamenei. It's not going to cause consternation for the president, Mr. Ahmadinejad. But it does have the possibility, through cumulative effect, of reminding Iran that we oppose some of their policies and showing people state by state that they can take actions contributing through their government to try to affect their life, their safety, and the activities of regimes that are not friendly toward our country. As Senator Bonhoeff said, I teach at William Mitchell. I teach national security law along with some other courses. I'm the director of something called the National Security Forum. We've had a number of speakers from the intelligence community, military community, Justice Department come and speak more broadly about national security issues. I am a former federal prosecutor. I tried cases for 6 years, had only one case that related to Iran. It was a person that violated the sanctions, the federal sanctions that apply to Iran. And I worked for 2 years after 9/11 as an assistant general counsel at the CIA. So my activities remain secret, and what I say to you today draws on either the unclassified activities that I had or the public record that I have. So I make clear I'm not drawing on any classified information. And if the CIA is watching, I'm not in trouble with them. I have done a lot of work more in the 90s related to Iran. I ran for a number of years what was called the Iran Commercial Initiative at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. That program, different from this suggestion, believed at the time that we could engage Iran in the commercial sector. We were more optimistic about the prior president, President Khatami, and we thought that through engagement, through meetings between American executives and Iranian officials, that we could build some of the steps for a better relationship. We also lobbied against the federal sanctions. We thought that the sanctions at that time did more harm than good. That was then, this is now. Back in that period, I also consulted with a number of groups, non-governmental organizations, that were trying to promote better ties through what we call Track 2 diplomacy. There were non-official contacts. This is with groups called Search for Common Ground, the American-Iranian Council, and a consulting group called the Eurasia Group. So I did make quite an effort working through this line of rapprochement with Iran back in the 90s, thinking that we could improve things, that the relationship could get better. We had a significant opportunity after 9/11, when it became clear that the Iranians were not involved. There was an opportunity for a breakthrough between our country and the Islamic Republic. The deal would have been very similar to what the Pakistanis accepted, that we would have let bygones be bygones. We would have focused on our common problem, Al-Qaeda. The Iranians did not accept the deal. There was probably too much bad blood between our countries. Maybe the interests did not align. But that, in my view, was the last recent opportunity to improve relations. And from that point on, the relationship has deteriorated. And one of the significant markers, I'm sure you all recall, would be the president's State of the Union address, where he labeled, I think rightly, Iran as a part of an axis of evil. And this responded to some of Iran's meddling in Afghanistan and a speech that the former president, Rafsanjani, made talking about nuclear weapons and destroying Israel in the same sentence. This, for obvious reasons, caused concern for the American administration, for our allies. And I think if you're looking for a point in time when the relationship hardened and got much worse, it would be that period at the end of 01, the beginning of 02. as Senator Bonhoff said, my parents are both from Iran, or hinted I'm of Iranian origin. I grew up in the States. I've worked in the government, but I have an interest in Iran. I speak Persian. I've written about Iran. I've made speeches talking about U.S.-Iran relations. But I confess to all of you here, that's not my primary area of responsibility. I focus more on issues related to the intelligence community, but I continue to write and think about Iran. It was just recently that gave a talk proposing a covert action program for dealing with the Islamic Republic. And if you're trying to figure out where to place me in my view of Iran, I don't think that just talking to Iran is going to work. That is not going to change their behavior. The Iranian regime does cost-benefit. They are pursuing their national interests, and they consider us to be in a weak position now. They think that time is on their side in the region. On the other hand, I rule out, I don't think that we're at the point where we need military action, that the consequences would be too great to us, too great to our allies. I don't think that we are in a situation where we're going to have imminent hostilities. So I'm looking for solutions somewhere in between just talking and military action that will increase the pressure on the Islamic Republic to modify their behavior, modify it so it suits our interests and suits the interests of our friends and allies. So that's my background, my point of view. Why is the Islamic Republic a threat? Here I'm summarizing, I think, what all of us know from the public record and the bits and pieces. One, and these problems, these threats have gone from administration to administration. So from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration to the Obama administration, I think we would all agree that these threats are problems with the Islamic Republic. So in that sense, I don't think this is a partisan issue. The reasonable minds in all parties agree that the Islamic Republic is a threat. We may disagree on the degree of the threat and what we do about it, but the Islamic Republic is not our friend. They're one of few countries that's listed as a state sponsor of terrorism. They're one of few countries with whom we have no diplomatic relations. It takes a lot to end up in those two groups. Their pursuit of nuclear weapons is a threat to our security. This president has made that clear, President Obama, the prior president, our allies have made that clear. Iran seems bent on pursuing a nuclear program. That causes instability. It creates a danger for our friends in the region, and not only to Israel, but to our other friends in the region who will be tempted to escalate or to create nuclear programs themselves to deal with the Iranian threat. It has been reported, and it is true, that there is an axis between Iran, a predominantly Shiite Muslim country, and our Arab friends there. They share a religion, but there are tensions that exist between Iran and countries like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, that are our friends. And if they see Iran getting powerful or they see Iran nuclear armed, they will be tempted. They will then pursue their interest to try to have more important weapons, which will destabilize the region. Iran is a state sponsor of terrorism. That's clear from our State Department. They've supported Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah. If you want to compare the threat, and Iran has been relatively restrained compared to al-Qaeda, but if Iran gets even more aggressive, Iran is in the major leagues compared to al-Qaeda, that Iran can inflict much more pain on the United States than al-Qaeda. It is a state-sponsored groups. We have various the intelligence ministries, the military, parastatal organizations, ties throughout the world, that this is a major terrorism threat to the United States and our friends. The potential for peace at this point between the Israelis and the Palestinians is bleak, but we have had breakthroughs out of bleak times, and Iran through the years has obstructed and been a problem in the peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians. The Iranians push the most radical side of the Palestinian movement, and they seem not to be interested in peace, and they provide pressure, or they make it very difficult for Palestinian leaders to try to find some middle ground with Israel. So that would be another area obstructing the peace process to the extent that it exists or to the extent that it has a potential in the region. And I think that we do have a potential with a turn in the administration, a new president. There is some hope that we can make progress between Israelis and Palestinians. Mr. Dean talked about the Iranian threat in Iraq. We know about their support for making devices there, of indirectly creating death and destruction in Iraq, killing Americans. They've also obstructed our efforts at stabilizing Afghanistan. So they're a destabilizing presence in the region on both sides, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan. And then the last area that I identify as a threat is the vast reserves of gas, natural gas, and oil that the Iranians have. It doesn't seem to be as much of a problem today with gas at $40-some dollars a barrel. But as our economy improves, as the price of oil goes up, Iran has this swing effect on the international market, and they've made clear that they are willing to use energy as a weapon against us or energy as a way to pursue their agenda. So I'll conclude in that area. I think most of us are going to agree that Iran is a threat. Where I would welcome questions or commentary is on how great the threat is. And what about this proposal that you're considering today? Why did my position evolve? I think the Islamic Republic is much more aggressive today than it was back in the 90s when I was trying to do things through this track two process. I think they've hardened their position. Their pursuit of nuclear weapons has accelerated. The problems that they're causing have gone there. And we've given diplomacy under this administration a lot of chances. Condoleezza Rice had an open invitation to the Iranians to sit down. They continue to snub her, and I think they will snub this administration. So as I said, I'm looking for an intermediate solution. And what's important to me is to make sure that these kind of measures are consistent with what the new administration is doing. We've seen the comments by Senator Obama, and this type of measure seems to fit into his idea of a balance of carrots and sticks. So it's something I mentioned to the supporters of this legislation. I would want to check with the White House or the State Department to make sure that this fits in. And I think you have enough evidence already that this fits in with the federal policy toward Iran. Well, let's be realistic. It's very early in the administration. I don't know that the Obama administration has done their Iran review. They're focused on more immediate problems for them, Guantanamo, the war on terror, our economy. But Iran will be high on the list. And I think when they get to dealing with Iran, they will find that measures like this, divestment, the cumulative effect, people expressing themselves, do fit in with the kind of carrots and sticks that they want to incorporate in their policy toward Iran.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Professor. Are there questions for Professor Radson? Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think anyone disagrees that Iran is a threat. My question more has to do whether will this be an effective strategy? And I know that this bill was the model for this bill was the Sudan divestment legislation, which I carried. And there is a very well-developed Sudan divestment group that monitors companies, that provides guidance to pension funds, that engages with companies, and they have a track record in proving that this strategy is successful. And we're talking about genocide. So there was kind of overwhelming evidence that this would be a good strategy. I'm just wondering if we have any evidence in this case if divestment will be influential on changing Iran's behavior.
Senator Bonoff?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, I asked that same question. I actually asked to I want some hard, specific examples of whether or not it's working with what we've done with regard to Sudan, and I still don't have those answers. Mm-hmm. So I'd be interested in hearing what the professor says. I think that we are early in this. I can tell you that 14 other states have done it. I spoke mm-hmm. to the legislators in Florida, and they said that that they worked for a long time researching it. They believe it will be effective. I can't answer that black and white.
Okay.
You know, it's my belief that diplomatic means, and I consider economic sanctions a mm-hmm. diplomatic means, are the first step. And so we as states have this opportunity, and that's why, and we know our federal government must think it's important because they've done so.
Senator
Pappas, do you have a comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, I would echo what Senator Bonhoff said. We're probably earlier in the process in assessing divestment related to Iran. What I think underlies your question, though, about Sudan and Iran is that perhaps there is a difference in the situations. And if that's true, I think Iran is more of a threat. It's easier to focus on Sudan. You agree the genocide. But if we're doing these things because we consider the countries to be a threat to our security, to our interests, and we're trying to change their behavior, I think that the case is even stronger for divestment in Iran. To follow up, do we know how strong of an effect this will have? I think the short answer is no. But we have many other states that are doing this. And we'll look at the cumulative effect. And it seems, I agree with Senator Bonhoeff, to play into the federal strategy of trying to influence Iran's behavior. I'll answer your question maybe indirectly. Is one of the areas that the federal government has been very effective is going to financial institutions and encouraging them not to deal with the Islamic Republic, not to open up letters of credit that facilitate Iran's trade, not with the United States. The sanctions prevent that. But it does get in the way of the dealings that Iran has with other countries. And that, from everything we can tell, including the complaining that has come from the Iranian government or Iranian business people, has been effective. There's not a fail-safe. There's not one solution to this problem. But we're looking at various measures and asking ourselves, is this something that is consistent with our interests, and is this something that will change their cost-benefit on the Iranian side? And the question, we can't get the president of Iran. I don't think he would be in favor of this measure.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Just one more. I was concerned with protecting the pension fund, but it does sound like you do have language in here, I think I saw it, that with their fiduciary responsibility, right, if they feel like there is going to be a problem, they can limit the divestment. I think in the Sudan legislation, we did have some kind of limits as to how much would be divested from the fund, one half of 1%, or it was a fairly small amount.
Yeah. Any other questions? Senator Carlson?
Madam Chair and Professor, I'm having a lot of trouble with this, I guess, because it seems like there's an awful lot of anecdotal and emotional testimony here. And, you know, some of the things that we've heard here, like, for instance, the manufacturer of the IEDs. Well, I think IEDs use cell phones a lot, and most of the cell phones are made in China. And a lot of the explosives are not made in Iran. So, you know, ought we add on some of the other countries? And ought we add on maybe Pakistan, where Osama bin Laden has been living for 7.5 years? And, you know, when we go back to 9/11, none of those
Saudi Arabia
were Iranians. They were more Saudi. And, you know, it seems like we've got a lot of emotion here that's maybe driving us. I would feel better if we would just be looking at the people on this State Department list and not saying the Islamic, the Islamic Republic of Iran, because it, you know, it almost appears like we're looking at a religious difference.
I take your point, Senator, and I don't.
Just a moment. I think that was pointed out at the beginning is that this Iran is one of four governments that is recognized as a terrorist state. So I think it is unique as opposed to where a cell phone is made, Senator Carlson. And the other category, Senator Bonhoeff, that Iran fits into, or a professor that you mentioned, another category, and it is even more unusual to have a country or a government that fits in both of those categories.
And the other category, we don't have diplomatic relations
with
Iran.
Yeah, and that we don't have diplomatic relations with them. So I think that there is there's enough uniqueness that it's not. I don't consider those two categories to be to come out of emotion, quite frankly, myself, Senator Carlson.
And, Madam Chair, to that, I would say we have a new administration that's only a week old. And this was from the former administration, which made some substantial errors in how they assessed where to go to war and who was responsible for things. So, you know, personally, I think the professor is right, that there might be a change in the way we deal with foreign countries, especially this one. In the future, we might find a way to reach out to them. And
Senator Carlson,
like
the legislation calls for, if there is a change in the status, that the legislation, the divestment is ratcheted back.
Right. But that requires an activity. What we're doing now is we're going to force the initiation of the divestment, and then the divestment can stop if there's a change. And what you're doing is you're preceding the change.
Madam Chair.
Senator Obama.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, I don't think you were here when I mentioned that President Obama, when he was U.S. Senator Obama, he carried the Iran Enabling Sanctions Act, forgive me if I've gotten the words backwards, to enable states to pursue this line. And he spoke for quite some time on the Senate floor talking about the role of states in being able to use this type of legislation to impact policy. So, in fact, that was one of the factors that I looked at in supporting this legislation.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonham.
Senator Carlson.
I was here, and that really makes no difference to me because that's national enabling legislation, but I still don't think that for a state legislature to get involved in foreign policy like this is really advisable.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Senator Stevens.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, I'd just like to take the opportunity to thank you for bringing this bill forward. And I'd also like to express my thanks to Mr. Dean for coming and testifying. I think that it's important that the legislature continually hear from service members who have seen firsthand the impact that state-sponsored terrorism can have on regular Minnesotans. And I don't in any way want this committee to seem as though it's hostile to hearing from Minnesotans who take the time to come here to testify at the Capitol. So I just wanted to make clear that I appreciate your testimony, as I know that many other members of the committee do. And Senator Bonoff, I support your legislation and am happy to move it when it's the appropriate time.
Thank you.
Actually, it's already been moved.
Okay.
Is there further questions for the professor? We do have testimony from Mr. Bicker, too. Senator Day?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Sieben, I agree with you, although maybe half of us wouldn't be here if we went under the the idea of, and this might be one of them, where this is totally above my pay grade, and I too think it's great that somebody would come and testify. That's how most of us arrived here, not knowing everything about everything. Just a general question. How many countries, somebody mentioned there's four countries that are on the terrorist list. Which ones are they?
Sudan, Sudan, Iran,
Syria.
Cuba, and Syria.
Not North Korea. Okay.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Are there further questions for this witness? Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate your being here. Both of you, again. Mr. Dean, we appreciate it. Mr. Bicker. Welcome to the committee, and if you would identify yourself, please, for the record, and I hope that in your testimony you will incorporate the response to the prior question asked by Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Howard Bicker. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Board of Investment. My board has not taken a formal position on this piece of legislation, so what I plan on providing the committee is just some factual information as it relates to this legislation and our investment portfolios. First of all, this legislation is similar but significantly different from the Sudan legislation. The Sudan legislation, when fully enacted, at this point in time, we've been divested approximately $24 million of securities. This legislation calls for us to put together a list of companies that may have some business operations in Iran. And we have attempted to put that list together, and it's being provided to the committee. At this stage, using December 31st numbers, this would affect approximately $280 million of our portfolio. It would also affect two-thirds of the international integrated oil companies. and it would affect approximately just slightly under 6% of our entire international portfolio. So from an investment standpoint, this bill has significantly more investment ramifications on an ongoing basis than the previous Sudan legislation that was passed. From a cost standpoint, if we were ultimately to liquidate approximately $280 million of securities, and again, this is a moving number, the list will change, and we'd obviously have to replace those securities. Generally speaking, you're looking at about a 1% round trip. So we'd be between $2 and $3 million of trading cost to implement this. Also, to Senator Pappas's questions and as related to Section 7, in the Sudan legislation, when that was passed, there was no ability for my board to not implement it. Right now in Section 7 in this bill, we have the ability, my board would have kind of ultimate veto rights, so to speak, depending on fiduciary responsibility, which actually puts us kind of between the rock and the hard place. You know, if the legislature enacts this, we would like to have some discussion as it relates to that provision because it really is putting us in a difficult position.
Would you explain why?
Well, I mean, now we're going to basically have to supersede your decision, potentially. If you want us to divest and we don't, we are kind of superseding the authority of the legislature. What I have suggested to Senator—
Mr. Bicker, in the Sudan legislation, how was that—
There was no provision for that. We had to go ahead directly.
But wouldn't it be, since the number is higher by tenfold at least, wouldn't it be prudent for the legislature to allow some discretion, or would a percentage be a would it be preferable from a policy standpoint? I'm not asking for your personal opinion or a personal belief. Would it be better from a policy perspective to put a percentage in and take out the discretionary authority of the investment board?
Madam Chair, that's a possibility. I'd have to think about that a little more.
Just a minute. I did have a brief conversation, by the way, with Senator Betzold, and because the bill is in front of our committee, the motion is to send it to the floor. But Senator Bonhoff, we would ask that before you took it up on the floor at any point, that you have a thorough vetting before the Pension Commission, and Senator Betzold invites you to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So,
and
Madam
so we
Chair,
would have your. You agree with that?
Yes, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, it sounds like we would then have some time to work out with Mr. Bicker the appropriate way to put some provision in the bill that would be amenable to him as well.
And Senator Bonhoff has been informed also that there's a correction that needs to be made in the bill that's Mr. Bodern found, and it's currently being drafted. Is that correct, Mr. Bonner?
Madam Chair, that's correct. It's just the way Subdivision 7 is worded. It needs some clarification.
Mr. Bicker, go ahead, and then we'll come back to questions.
Well, Madam Chair and members, I mean, I could carry on and do some more, but...
Or you could take your phone
call. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I guess I'll respond to any questions.
Okay. Senator Olsing.
Madam Chair, my question would be, these companies listed on the left-hand side where it says the manager name,
mm-hmm.
So are these... Does the state investment or the pension fund own these directly as stocks, or are they through like a mutual fund type of a thing so that they're not directly owned? Let me see how that would be.
Madam Chair and Senator, We retain individual organizations to help manage our equity portfolio, but they are separate accounts. We own the stocks individually. We, for the pension-related assets, do not deal in mutual funds. We can negotiate a much better cost arrangement individually than we can through a mutual fund.
Okay, so then, Senator Olson, these are the actual stocks then that are in the portfolio, and these are just the managers that listed on the left-hand side. Okay.
Madam Chair and Senator, that's absolutely correct.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, you said this would be 6% of our international portfolio. What percent of our whole portfolio is the international portfolio? So in total, what percent is this of our portfolio?
Mr. Bicker.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, we have approximately 15% exposure to international. So in aggregate, it's around 1% of their entire portfolio.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Bicker, did you say that trading costs for implementing this are about $2 to $3 million?
Mr. Bicker.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, it's about a 1% round trip cost. $280 million is approximately $2 to $3 million.
And, Senator Marty.
And Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, I was wondering in terms of, and I apologize, I wasn't here at the beginning, but did you talk about, have you worked with some of the groups of, like I know in these situations, like somebody mentioned middle-class Iranian families, and whether if something like this would hurt them because they're supposedly a strong opposition group in Iran. Wonder if the people who are pushing this have talked with some of the NGOs and so on who work in Iran and around there, see if this is consistent with what they're doing. You talked a little bit about this being consistent with U.S. government policy, but I was just curious about whether there have been such contacts to see whether people there feel this is a plus or a minus.
Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I have not done that, and I want to make sure you understand that this legislation is about divesting from companies that are doing business in the oil and gas sector, so it is not it is not all pervasive. We're strictly talking about the oil and gas sector.
Further questions? Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, just a comment, and that is that I think this may be a very wise thing to do to help the case. On the other hand, if it's maybe this will help, maybe it won't help, then you got to ask, is it worth $2 to $3 million to decide that it might help? It's obviously a big issue. If it can make a difference in foreign policy, that's good. But if it might possibly make a difference, then the question is it worth $2 to $3 million to do so?
Well, Senator Marty, as Senator Bonoff has pointed out earlier, too, we're not in this alone. A number of other states are taking a similar action in order to have a group effect, is what I'm assuming.
Senator Chair.
Pappas.
Sorry.
Well, Madam Chair, the goal is to get the companies to agree to withdraw from Iran. So the goal is actually not to have the pension fund divest. The goal is to influence the behavior of the companies. So my question, Senator Bonoff, is there an entity, I don't know who they are, like with Sudan, there was an entity, the Sudan divestment, blah, 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 that engaged with companies and to persuade them, if you will, to withdraw from Darfur. So is there a similar entity, and maybe Jacob knows, that is doing the same thing with companies in Iran? Because the engagement thing, I think, is what's really key and what will make this successful.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, I don't have that answer. I do know that as part of the legislation that we give notice, then we give a time period for them to come back to us and tell us if they've taken action towards divesting, and then we respond to that. That is built into it, whether or not there's a group.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know if that's Senator a good Pappas. Responsibility for the pension board to do that. I mean, that seems like there needs to be somebody else that's doing that. I think Mr. Bicker wants to
Mr.
say something.
Mr. Bicker.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, when we have seen, when we saw this legislation, and we've seen some other forms of legislation, we have always strongly recommended to the various groups that you are much more effective if you want to affect change in a corporation by sponsoring a shareholder resolution than they are by selling their stock. You sell their stock, you get your name in the paper one day, and you go away. If you initiate shareholder resolutions, you're an ongoing thorn in the side of those companies, and you can also get other entities, public entities, private entities, to help you support those shareholder resolutions. And you're much more effective. I mean, I've used the example, and you may not like this, but it's, you know, a constituent calls you up once and gets mad at you for 2 minutes on the phone and hangs up. Well, you don't like that, but they made the phone call. Now, if they call back every week, you don't like that. It's kind of like a proxy resolution. You know you're going to keep coming back at you. If I go out and sell these stocks tomorrow, the reality is most of these companies won't care. They really won't care. Fact is, they would rather me sell the stocks than to become a problem for them. And if you want to, in my opinion, again, this is my opinion, I don't want to get my board members or whatever, this is my opinion, we'd be much better off. And I really shouldn't say this because it's going to be a heck of a lot more work for my staff if we do this than if we just sold the stocks. But I think if you really want to affect change, you want to do something, you initiate shareholder resolutions, and you don't liquidate stocks.
Senator Madam Bonoff? Chair, Senator Pappas, we did, I got a note from Jacob that just recently Total Nigeria, which was on the list based on the other states doing what they did, recently decided not to expand business in Iran. So that's the, I don't think that answers your question,
that's a good
but
example.
They have had some success.
Is there further, are there further questions for Mr. Bicker? Or for Senator Bob.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Bicker. We appreciate your service, too. You are a great asset to the state of Minnesota. You are.
Not so great lately. But.
Well, not your fault. Senator Bonoff, we have the A1 amendment, which is a clarification of the intent of that Section 7. Would you like to offer it as an author's amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I offer the A1.
Do you have a copy of it?
It's coming.
It's coming right now. Give it to her first, please. Then hand it out to members. That's fine. Mr. Bodden, would you explain how this is a clarification? It is an author's amendment, but I think we need to understand it, too, Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair and members, if you look at on page 4, subdivision 7, paragraph A, I think that paragraph is a little difficult to understand, partly because it's not written in short declarative sentences, and it may, in fact, contradict itself. It looks like, I think what it intends to say is that if the board determines that it cannot divest from a company consistent with its fiduciary duty, it should be allowed to make that determination and then report it to the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. And without going too far into it, if you read that sentence, at least the first sentence in paragraph A, that is not entirely clear because it says if the board determines the action is consistent with its fiduciary responsibilities, mm-hmm. then it must report that determination. Right. So what the amendment does, and I've use this form just so that you'll be able to read rather than individual page and line changes, you'll be able to read most of what the new paragraph would look like. It would say that if the State Board of Investment determines in good faith that the action required by this section is inconsistent with the fiduciary responsibilities of the board is not required to make, and there needs to be one small oral amendment made to the amendment, the board is not required to make any divestment required by this section.
And where
the amendment to the amendment would be on page 1, line 5 of the amendment, delete take action and insert make any divestment. That's another problem with the way the paragraph is written right now.
That change to the amendment will be incorporated.
Most of the rest of that paragraph reads the same way it was originally written, with the exception of a couple of minor items in the last few sentences. relating to the use of such and the past tense of the reports that are filed that you'll see in the last sentence. Otherwise, I think it's
okay,
pretty straightforward.
This is an author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We have Senate File 131 before us as amended. Is there a further question? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a co-author on the bill, and when I did do that, I didn't realize that I wasn't thinking about a cost of divesting, and that's why at this point I think it is all the more important that we give the State Board of Investments the authority to decide if it's in our best interest to do that at this time or not. I wouldn't want to change that, although we actually are saying to the board, I think, we would like to do this if possible, if it isn't going to severely harm our portfolio or our earnings, which we know are down terribly right now. But I think that it is important to leave it to the people who know how to make these investments to determine to, if this is something that we can do during this time when we're losing a lot of money in the stock market as it is. So I guess I don't feel uncomfortable giving you that authority, and I won't be mad if you decide not to exercise it, because you know the situation of our pension funds much better than we do, the intricacies of it. And so I would not be upset if that was a decision that the board made. So I still feel fairly comfortable with this because that is included in there. And we do in many ways want to make a statement. And if we can work together with other states to make a bigger statement, it certainly would be more effective. And as was stated, we are the shareholders. We can put in resolutions, and that may be something that we should consider doing in lieu of divesting. I really you know, this isn't my specialty. And I'm glad it's going to the Pension Commission because it is more their specialty. But I also know that the Board of Investments, that it's really their specialty. So that's why
I think we've got to do. I think you capture what a number of us feel. With the we did not adopt the amendment correctly, so we need a member of the committee to move it. Senator Roebling moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have, correctly have Senate File 131 before us as amended. Senator Lori moves that Senate File 131 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Russ.
Senator Bonoff, and we expect you to take this proposal before the Pension Commission before you act on it on the floor.
Thank you. It was incorporated.
Senator Torres Ray.
She incorporated it. She just didn't have time to move it.
A resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Instead of the
thank you for the opportunity to bring this to your attention. I am here to ask for your support on extending the deadline for the commission that was created in 2007 to undertake activities necessary to assist state government to foster an understanding and appreciation of ethnic and cultural diversity in Minnesota. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this was a piece of legislation that was adopted in last year, and we had the privilege to serve. I had the privilege to serve in a committee of 8 members, and 4 members that represented the community and a very diverse group of people with tremendous expertise in this area, and 4 members of the legislature. What happened during this process is that we were able to convene, get to know each other, get some information. But as you can imagine, this is really a very broad mandate, and we were able to get the information together. In the process, we found out that other groups have done similar work. And so we tried to find those reports that were put in place by those specific groups. We also asked the demographer to come and testify before our committee, and we had really ample opportunities to look at this, but we really ran out of time. We met five times, and we are asking for an extension of these deadlines so that we can put together the information and come up with a report that we can bring before the legislature with recommendations. And so this is what this recommendation and this bill is about. And we are asking for an extension for June 30th of 2011. And I wanted to, I know, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that you wanted us to go through this quickly, but I have two members of the committee who wish to give a brief testimony because think we had a great...
Absolutely. You may have the time that you need, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. So I would like to invite Mr. John Keller, who is the Executive Director of the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota, and Mr. Joe Swedberg, who is the Vice President of Legislative and Marketing Services for Hormel Food Corporations. The reason I have invited these two representatives of our working group is because they really represent a very different constituency, two different constituency groups that were so important to this particular group. They serve, Mr. Keller is an attorney that represents really many, many clients in his organization, and he will speak about, you know, his experiences and how valuable was the experience of being part of this committee. And Mr. Swedberg is really working with a business, with a company that hires many immigrants and has is involved with many other business individuals who work in the private sector, and also brings that perspective to the committee, and he would like to share that with you.
Mr. Keller, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's my pleasure to testify once again. It was my pleasure when this piece of legislation first came up.
Mr. Keller, you need to say your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. John Keller from the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota. I'm the director of the organization. I've been on staff there full-time since 98 and as a student since 94. The Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota, just in terms of background, it's a nonprofit. We provide legal services to low-income immigrants and refugees who have some sort of remedy under the federal laws. We do only immigration law. We have a sub-office in Worthington and a sub-office in the Neighborhood House. Otherwise, our main office is right down University Avenue on Syndicate. Last year, we represented almost 1,900 different legal matters for our clients, and our clients came from 86 different countries. I am a member of the working group, and I was fortunate, as I started to say, to provide testimony 2 years ago when this committee and the House also considered the idea of a Minnesota working group. It's been my honor to be named and to work on the committee, and the long and the short of my testimony is that there is so much to do, and we've had very, very little time to address it. So the extension that we're requesting is really to focus on some of the areas we've begun and also some policy recommendations that should be coming out very shortly in terms of where we go from here. The three main reasons why I think it's important that this committee exist and continue to exist is to recognize both the need on a social side for Minnesota to portray a welcoming face to new Americans and immigrants and refugees to Minnesota. We almost every year are either the first or second highest receiving state in terms of refugees of all of the 50 states, and we have created programs. There's a history here really beginning with the Refugee Act in the 80s of being that welcoming state, and we need to continue to do that. One of the main reasons we need to continue to do that is for economic reasons. The workforce shortages, particularly brought about by the graying of Minnesotans over the long term, is interestingly accented and alleviated by a very young demographic of immigrants and refugees who are arriving. One of the first presentations was by the state demographer Tom Gillespie, and it's part of the record on our website for this committee about the need for ongoing workers, and especially younger workers. And finally, welcoming and providing policy recommendations through this diverse group of both business, nonprofit, legal, and public officials provides an area where the best thinking and really recommendations outside of the floor and outside of politics can be discussed, and recommendations from that dynamic and diverse group can come forward. It is hoped that if there's an extension, we'll be able to do some of the following. One of the important meetings that we had of the four, really, that took off since August was to bring in representatives from Iowa's New Americans Commission as well as Illinois' Commission on New Americans. Both states are many, many years ahead of what Minnesota is undertaking and began the work in those two states with a partnership between federal dollars and foundation dollars and private philanthropy. We think that there is the possibility to do that here in Minnesota as well, especially under these economic circumstances. I've had one preliminary conversation with a funder who funded the Illinois area commission and is interested in this commission as well in helping it get off the ground. And I know that there is interest in state foundations as well. Those two states' initiatives have focused on workforce, making really connections in between the workforce needs of their particular states. Iowa, even more so than Minnesota, has suffered and identified workforce shortages much earlier than we did, and really partnering resources to help new Americans in that state to become more effective and efficient in the workplace. I'm going to stop out of considerations of time and turn it over to Mr. Swedberg for the position from his point of view.
Thank you, Mr. Keller, and thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Swedberg, and before you begin your testimony on behalf of the legislature, I'd like to thank you for your service on the Sesquicentennial Commission. We appreciated that very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, my name is Joe Swedberg. I'm Vice President of Legislative Affairs for Hormel Foods Corporation based in Austin, Minnesota. We're also the parent company of Jennie-O Turkey Store based out of Wilmer, Minnesota. So with that, we have, total as a company, around 19,500 employees nationally and internationally. But in Minnesota, we have around 8,000 employees. And as Senator Torres-Reyes indicated, we have a diverse workforce within our population in Minnesota. And what I'll do with you is just take a couple minutes to share from the business perspective what this means to us and why my interest of being in the commission and having the privilege to work with the others in the commission has been so important. We have just begun our work, as both have indicated prior to this, but being a company that's been in Minnesota for 117 years, we have a rich history in Minnesota, and it was started by a German immigrant from coming in and settling in Austin, Minnesota. So we have a long history of immigration right within our own company, as you well know from many of your own backgrounds. Today's climate has changed dramatically. We have a number of new immigrants coming into Minnesota, primarily because there's work here. And we have opportunities within our state. As we look forward with the demographer's information, our company, one of our biggest fears, and I'm sure many companies, is where are we going to find our workforce in 10, 15 years? And it is many of the baby boomers will be retiring, and we are going to have an urgent need for a workforce and many different skilled areas across the board. And one of our devotions is to look at technology. How can we add more technology to our business so we can get along? Because we are concerned about the workforce issue. With this working group, I think we've put together a good group of objectives, but now is our opportunity to put together our strategy and tactics. And I think Minnesota has a unique opportunity with some of the examples that have been formed around the state with assimilating and welcoming immigrant workforce. One prime example, I think they're maybe the stellar example of the state, was Wilmer, Minnesota. That community has done a terrific job, and I think those are examples that we can build on from this commission. I think we need to look at our history of immigration in Minnesota, remind people of that. We need to look at where we're at presently, and we need to look at where we're going in the future and what the needs are. And I think there's an opportunity to put together an economic impact study with the help of the foundations. And I think at the end of the day, people need to look at this issue, and I think many people will reasonably look at this issue and see when it does is presented to them in a reasonable, concise manner that it does have an impact on them either directly or indirectly on a ready and available workforce in Minnesota. And as we look at the positive impacts that many of the folks that have come into Minnesota throughout history, not only recently but in past history, I think we'll have a good opportunity to frame up the position that we are trying to take and show people that this is important to them, because at the end of the day, if we do not do this and we don't have a position that lets people know that this does impact me personally, either directly or indirectly, that will be a challenge. And I think this commission has moved forward directly in that fashion. I think we have some work ahead of us that can be done and be very relevant at a very economical way with great return. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Swedberg. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Swedberg or Mr. Keller? Senator Vicar.
Madam Chair, I have to also support this because I know what a large group we have in my city of Worthington, Swift Plan. They want to add another 200, and they will do that. They process, if you can imagine, 18,000 hogs a day. I couldn't count 18,000 hogs. That's what they do. And they've come into their community. They bought homes, bought cars, they borrowed money, and they're well received in that part of the state. And besides that, I have some large dairies in the Edgerton area. They're in, they help milk cows. You know something? They always show up for work. Some of us maybe kind of don't show up for work, but they show up for work and they stay and they put in a full day. They do. And so I can't say enough for them. We can't operate without them. We just couldn't. You might as well shut it down.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Vickerman. So we have Senate File 185 before us. Senator Gimsey, would you like to move the bill?
I'd certainly like to move it, but can I make a comment?
You certainly prior to can, that? But can we get the bill moved and then we'll come back to it? So Senator Gimsey will move that Senate File 185 be recommended to pass, and Senator Torres Ray, the bill needs to go to the Rules Committee. Senator Gimsey makes that motion, but now Senator Gimsey, comment.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And I also want to thank Senator Torres Ray for her guidance on this working group. I also serve on it, yes, with her, and we have come a long ways, and like Joe and John said, we have a lot to do. But the outlook and the forward thinking of this group, and I believe that their ability moving forward is going to be tremendous in creating an atmosphere in this state, or helping to enhance the atmosphere in this state of acceptance of immigrants and immigrants coming in to our communities. And I'm pleased to be a part of that group. One of the things that I'm going to point out that John Keller does, and he does yeoman's work in a somewhat of a thankless job, I believe, some of the time, probably having to say no or I can't help you to a lot of individuals who contact him. But his Citizenship Day that was part of a around the state day of informing immigrants on how they can become citizens, what they needed to do, was terrific. He was in Wilmer this past year, and we had, 50 or 60 folks come through, get the information that they need to find out about how they can actually become citizens, and it was a great day in Walmart. And I just hope that we can grow that and expand it and make it even better. But I
thank you,
move the
Senator
bill.
Gamson.
Thank you.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed that it says on 114 that The commission may provide compensation for public members as provided in section da-da-da. And I'm wondering if there's
commission
a fiscal...
refers to the LCC.
Okay. So I'm wondering if there is a fiscal note with this that we should be... I know we're not a fiscal committee, but I'm wondering if there's not a fiscal note attached
to
this.
Before we did this, the bill just went... When we established it, to start with, the bill went from here to rules because it has legislators on it. I think that... Beg pardon?
And because it involves the LCC.
And because it involves the Legislative Coordinating Commission. So I think the Rules Committee would make the determination whether it needed to go to Finance following that.
Okay. I'm on Finance, so I could see it
right
there probably.
Yeah.
I saw Mr. Hubinger here and was wondering if he wanted to comment on cost.
What happened was the new commission itself, like other proposals that had that were proposing commissions last year, were instead set up as working groups out of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And so that's what is reflected here. And so what they're asking for is the working group to be extended for 2 years under the jurisdiction of the Legislative Coordinating Commission.
Madam Chair and Senator Robley, just for your information, none of the members of the committee have ever submitted any expense report, and we have not reimbursed anybody for mileage or per diem. They have not asked for it, and we think that it's unlikely that we will receive it even if they submitted an expense report. But just wanted to point out to the committee, Madam Chair, is that this is just an amazing group, and they are very willing to continue to work on this and spend as many hours as we need to complete our report for the legislature and continue to do our the work. And they have not asked for compensation or reimbursement of mileage. So if that I know that these are very difficult times, and if that is the case, they all have expressed a desire to continue. They've never received reimbursement, and they don't intend to submit.
Senator Torres-Rame also informed that Mr. Hubinger has let us know that the whatever expenses there have been for them have been paid out of the contingency fund of the LCC. So it's not an additional appropriation or anything. And only there would only be an issue if that particular contingency fund itself was zeroed out. Is there further discussion or questions? Seeing none, Senator Gimsey renews his motion that Senate File 185 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Torres-Rame.
Thank you,
Madam
Chair. Thank you, members.
There being no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned.